Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. At hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
My name is Jari Bolander. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Ethos Podcast. On this podcast, we're going to take a deep dive into the traits, values, beliefs, and skills of all sorts of entrepreneurs to learn how to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient world. Let's get started.
Hello, everyone. I wanted to jump in quickly to let you know about the release of the audio version of my book, The Entrepreneur Ethos, narrated by David A. Knesser. If you want to support the show, you can buy it wherever audiobooks are sold. Links are also in the show notes. Now on to my guest for today, Roy Harmon, founder of Advertoscope. Digital marketer Roy Harmon recounts how he went from law school to marketing by way of political campaigns. After running for office himself, he learned that he loved marketing, and he's since built a career helping companies plan and execute marketing campaigns. When COVID hit and work for his employer dried up, Roy struck out on his own, founding Advertoscope, a digital marketing campaign company. According to Roy, finding your why, the inner motivations for doing what you do, can make the difference between success and failure, whether you're a politician or an entrepreneur. We also talk about the limits of metrics in marketing and the importance of simply establishing a baseline for public relations in marketing before looking at analytics. Since many of the businesses he works with are about solving problems, one of the first challenges of good marketing often starts with educating people about the problems and solutions that you may offer. Now, let's get better together. Roy Harmon, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Jari. I'm really excited.
Yeah, I'm excited too. You're like the first guest that actually brought up the story grid. That is not part of the story grid. So I cannot wait to talk about, your aspirations as a novelist and all the good stuff about Advertoscope that you're doing and all that. But before we do that, as I always like to do, why don't you give us a little background and tell us how you got to be doing what you're doing?
Yeah, I got started, I guess it was 10 years ago. I was in law school and I wanted to go into politics, and I worked for a political consulting firm, and I ran for office and did all the things that an aspiring politician does. And throughout law school, I got more and more interested in the marketing side of things. I worked for a great company. I was an intern at Push Digital, which is a South Carolina company that does political marketing. And so after law school, I went into politics. I started working for a Senate campaign. I moved to DC, worked for some big nonprofits up there, and then gradually just got burnt out with all of the political stuff. And so I segued out of that. And when my wife found out she was pregnant, we decided to move back to South Carolina to be close to our family. And that was the perfect time for me to get out of politics altogether. And standing where I stand today with the current political climate, I feel like that was a great decision.
Yeah, stroke of genius, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. So I did. I moved into doing PPC and eventually started working for a software company doing demand generation. And that's what I've been doing ever since. Most recently working for a MarTech company here in South Carolina. And then, the coronavirus sort of ravaged the industry, and we lost a lot of clients, and so I was let go. But I had been writing for Vertiscope, my blog, and writing a lot of things about SaaS marketing, especially B2B SaaS marketing. And so I had already been getting leads through that. And so I just transitioned into doing that full time, which was always a dream of mine to be able to be my own boss. Growing up, my dad, he's always been his own boss. So I always looked up to him, and that was a big part of what drove me. But I thought, my wife is a teacher, and so this was not the ideal time to do it. And I probably would have waited two or three more years if I hadn't been forced into it. But as these things often go, it actually turned out to be the best thing that could have happened to me. Because very quickly I was able to be in a position where now I don't have to worry about working for somebody else other than my clients, which I really enjoy. For some reason I enjoy that client, having a relationship with clients rather than an employer. And so that's been really great.
Wow. That's quite the journey. You're the first. Yeah. I think you're probably one of the first person I've talked to that COVID actually pushed them pretty hard into, okay, now I'm going to go pursue kind of my side hustle, right?
Yeah.
Which is great. I mean, it's interesting how pandemics accelerate a lot of things.
It's always true.
Yeah, it's awesome in one sense, but then not so awesome in the other sense.
Well, exactly. And that's it feels kind of weird because, I am doing well for myself, but at the same time, there are so many people out there who are really struggling. People who are close to me are really having a lot of trouble, but at the same time, it's nice for me to be able to be in a position where I can help them out and do what I can. So, overall, yeah, for me, it's been a good thing. But at the same time, I'm really looking forward to being able to get out of the house again.
Yeah, no, me too. I mean, I'm in San Francisco, and I live in a city, so I can enjoy a city as opposed to just being in my apartment all day. I mean, I'm not in it all day, but there's certain trappings of being in a city. I'm curious, what did you run for in your political?
I ran for State House. So I was taking a legislative process course from the clerk of the South Carolina State House. And he always told us that here in South Carolina, we actually have very few attorneys. There's always this thought that there's a ton of attorneys who run for office, and there are, but actually in South Carolina, at least, it's much more like people in insurance and things like that who are kind of running our government. And there's actually a fair amount of times when developing laws that it's actually can be beneficial to have an attorney around. So,
for sure.
So he really pushed us to do that. And we had there was a special election in my hometown, which was about an hour and a half from school. And so I decided to run for it. and it was an interesting experience. I had to go to school, and a lot of it was happening during finals. So I was in class, and then I would go on Fridays to be available for to meet with people, and I'd go and knock on doors on the weekends, and I did a lot of marketing for myself, which was my favorite part about it. And what I enjoyed about politics in general was that marketing side of it. And of course I didn't win, but there were five people running, and I think almost all of them were either retired or self-employed and had all this time and money to do all these different things. So I was really pleased to come in third place, and to at least I wasn't last. So it was a great experience, and one that I don't know if I would rule it out, but I think I'm probably more likely to finish a novel than I am to run for office again.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm involved with politics here in San Francisco. Not a lot anymore, not a lot lately, but I just really appreciate the fact that people run, and mm-hmm. being a candidate is a hard, hard thing. I mean, it's, you know, people say, they're doing it for the power and the prestige or whatever. And, you know, there may be a certain part of that, but I mean, the scrutiny, the public scrutiny, the so much time, I mean, your time is just not your own. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that, you know, I've been a part of some campaigns, and I always looked at the candidate, and, you know, I could see how hard they're working, and for whatever their motivations, you know, it varies, of course. But boy, talk about a process that is extremely revealing to oneself, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, this whole marketing yourself thing, that's the reason why I wanted to pull on that thread, because boy, a lot of entrepreneurs should learn from politicians the good things about that. Of course, not mm-hmm. the bad things, but what did you learn from being a candidate for political office that now helps you being an entrepreneur?
So I think you're right about that. And there were a couple of things. One of the first things I had to figure out was, why am I running?
Yeah.
You know, you have to have a reason. That's one of the biggest things that I can't remember who it was, but there was somebody who just sank their entire campaign because somebody said, why do you want to be X? And they didn't know. They couldn't say. And it's, you know, for anybody, whether it's a product, service, or a candidate, if the person doesn't even know why they're doing it, that's a red flag. So I had to figure out, why am I doing this? And then I had to position myself in a way that let people understand why I'm the one they should choose. And that positioning is something that, when it comes to developing a unique selling proposition, you know, figuring out your key differentiators, that's been a huge help to me ever since. But those two things were really big. And then, you know, when you hear people talk about doing things that don't scale, that's a big part of politics, because knocking on doors and making phone calls, as much as people work on new software and as you can do as much grassroots as you want to get volunteers together to help you with that, it's really hard to scale personal engagement with voters.
Yeah.
But it's very important. Yeah. And that grassroots approach is something that, especially working with smaller startups, it's hugely important.
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm with you. I mean, again, all the politicians that I know, and seeing them and being on some of their campaigns, the amount of time they had to spend with people, that personal time, clearly doesn't scale because there's only so many hours in the day. But boy, the impact of that is remarkable. And I think for startups, especially young startups, that mentality of hitting the pavement, knocking on doors, really being intimate with the customer and spending the time. And of course, I know, of course, it doesn't scale because it can't, but I just know, like in local politics, you know, grassroots, you know, knocking on doors, calling people, being interactive is like absolutely critical. I mean, here in San Francisco, it's critical. I mean, you can't be a candidate around here without kissing babies and knocking on doors. I mean, yeah. now it's going to be a lot harder since we're still in the COVID thing. And we actually do have an election coming up in November. So, but that's so fascinating because, you know, I always like to see or try to get at the heart of how other things apply to other things. So what's the crossover between entrepreneurship and politician, right? Mm-hmm. And then the converse is true too. As a bureaucrat, politico, city worker, et cetera, how can you take entrepreneur skills and creativity and apply that to government? Because I'm actually on this task force right now. We're trying to figure out how to reopen San Francisco and have artists and entrepreneurs involved in the policy process. And it's fascinating. The thought process is like,
yeah.
Why are we talking about money? And they're like, oh, we can't afford it. It's like, no, stop. Look, no. Let's not worry about the money until we have a plan. Then we'll go figure out how to pay for the plan. Don't constrain yourself by the economics that you don't even know what the economics are yet, right? Stuff like that.
Right.
So how do you do that with your clients? I mean, it sounds like you got a very unique position to come from, which I think is sorely needed. One of what's your why, which I totally agree with. And then, you know, hitting the pavement, you know, the answer is not in the building. Like if you want to go for quote unquote scale, that comes later. You got to get the fundamentals. I mean, if you scale the wrong thing, it just doesn't make sense, right? How does that process work with the clients that you're working with?
One thing for me, I have to really, when it comes to things that don't scale, one thing that really does scale is PPC. And so for me, I lean on that a lot. Hmm. And I have to remember that, especially in the early stages, it may not be time for that. I mean, for one thing, you know, nothing kills a bad product faster than good marketing.
And yes.
And for another thing, you don't know if you're doing good marketing or not. Right. I work with a lot of category creators, people who are meeting unmet needs that people don't even realize they have the problem, but they don't even realize that it's a problem that can be fixed.
Yeah.
And it kind of reminds me, I grew up not being somebody who was really a handyman, and I would walk into this room in my house growing up, and I was just like, man, I can't turn the fan on because it's making this noise, and it's like the fan is hitting the light, and it gets hot in here, and I can't have any air going. And then one day I just realized, like, all I need to do is take a screwdriver and screw in that propeller so it's not hitting the light anymore. And then I felt like a genius. And actually ever since then, I actually now, you know, I spend so much time in the garage, and I love, I would not at all consider myself a true craftsman, but I love to build things put my other things on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Anything that requires no precision. I just like nailing 2x4s together. But it's so much that way with everything. There are people don't even think about it. I had a product that I was working for them. They had a very specific product, but it could do a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And I went into Reddit just trying to do some market research, and I knew what the product did, and I just asked, is there something how would I do this? Mm-hmm. And everybody said, oh, you can't do that. But it took them forever to even understand what I was looking for.
Right.
So that's such a huge problem when you're trying to say, how do I get people to understand what this can do when they don't even fully understand the problem? And of course, that's where the whole inbound marketing and the content marketing education comes in. And it's very important, but it's not something that many people focus on. And it's sometimes hard to show the ROI there, but you kind of have to check that box, figure that out before you can move on to the things that, you know, have a more demonstrable ROI.
Yeah. No, I have the same problem in, you know, I run now a PR and marketing firm that my late wife started. You know, she passed away 3 years ago from leukemia. And, you know, when I started to run it while she was sick, and everyone would always ask me, you know, I have an engineering background, as most people know. So I'm like very analytical and, you know, like, show me the numbers, like this, you know, pay-per-click, you know, thing is like, oh, I get it. You know, I've done a little bit of that. It's not my expertise, but I understand the feedback loop. Like, feedback loops for me, closing the loop, making sure that you get that feedback to kind of spin up the flywheel, right? Mm-hmm. I totally get all that. And I remember someone asked me, and it was a client, it was a technical product, and they're like, so what's the return on all this PR and marketing? Like, how do I know you're being successful to me? And I'm like, well, that's a great question, because, you know, some days I don't even know what it's successful, right? I don't. Sometimes it's black magic, sometimes it's alchemy. And it's a lot of both, right? But not black magic, sorry. It's mostly alchemy, because there's a lot of good things that you do to pull together to pull something else. And there's a lot of creativity, and there's metrics and stuff, but like, I don't know what your ROI is on PR spend. Like, what's your return on PR spend, right?
Right.
And then so what I started to think about, and this is why I really like your approach, is that there's a baseline level of PR and marketing that every company must do. Like, absolute bottom, like, you can't not do it. Because you have to have that baseline in order to jump up and figure out what campaigns will work. So if you don't have that baseline level, if you don't have some sort of cadence of PR marketing, even ads, like there's a basal level of activity, mm-hmm. you will have no idea what your ROI could be, right? But you have to have that minimum. And that minimum is the cost of playing the game. Would you agree with that?
Definitely. I definitely agree. And I think part of the issue is that you see, thanks to all the data that we can get now, people want to only focus on the things that they can track.
Yeah.
So it's almost like, you know, if you had a metal detector, and it's like, wow, this thing is really good at detecting metal. But that doesn't mean that things that aren't metal don't have any value. You know, I mean, it's totally, like, totally. A lot of the things that we do that are valuable, and there's a guy named Chris Walker, who's always talking about this on LinkedIn and the importance of doing these things that happen earlier, that happen before you get to that point. And we've got this over-reliance on data now, and it's led to this extreme shift towards direct response style marketing, which we were too far the other way at first. People were on doing Facebook marketing and just tracking how many people liked them and things like that, which that definitely can be absurd, and it probably tends to usually be absurd. You know, it doesn't really matter how many people like you on Facebook,
yeah.
especially now that you're not going to get any organic reach anyway.
No. Yeah, totally.
But we've gone so far that a guy I really respect named Bill Reynolds, he is one of the VPs at that at the MarTech company I worked at before I went out on my own. And he was telling me that he was sitting in on a seminar, and the guy was talking about how if you can't measure it, it's worthless. And the guy said, well, I mean, what about the advertising that Coke does? I mean, you can't, all the branding they do, I mean, they're able to go in this see lift, and, you know, you can break things down and do look at year over year stats and things like that. But just because you can't fully encapsulate the value in terms of some KPI doesn't mean that it's worthless.
I agree. I always think that there's the cost to play the game, is what I like to say. And the cost mm-hmm. to play the game in a business is there's a certain level of PR and marketing that you have to do, and you just have to do it, and you just got to suck it up, and you got to stop trying to metricize.
That's your buy-in. That's table stakes.
Yeah, that's table stakes, right? That's your buy-in. And I think we have to start talking more about that is, you know, PR marketing professionals, you know, we do similar things. You and I just, I think you probably do it in a different way, but you know, I'm always trying to get across like the why and the story and what's the narrative, because a lot of that stuff drives the rest of the digital strategy. It also drives the ad strategy. It also right. drives the message. And if that's all, you know, disjointed, you know, no amount of, you know, analytics on pay-per-click, analytics on, you know, email capture from a Facebook ad or whatever, or Instagram or whatever your favorite metric is, or is going to matter. But yeah, I mean, I it is interesting that, yeah, maybe I should think about writing a piece on that, like your buy-in. I like that. Yeah. I really like that kind of metaphor. Like, this is the buy-in for business. If you don't do it, like, don't expect any of that other stuff to work, because I do think you need that baseline level. I used to call it I still do, the kind of the marketing and PR cadence. Like, people need to know you're alive and yeah. you're doing stuff. Because one time I had a client, potential client, they said, hey, oh, we're going to launch a product. I'm all, oh, great. Yeah, we're going to do it in a month. And I'm all, a month? Like, you can't, like, is this like PR marketing an afterthought? They're like, oh, yeah, we'll just want it to go viral. I'm like, what? Viral? What planet yeah. are you on? You know, and I didn't take the gig, and I said, hey, I gave him some advice. Like, look, you know, this is the, you know, the buy-in for your business or whatever, which again, great, great. It's a really good concept. You should write a book on that.
I don't know. I kind of feel like I was riffing off your idea.
Well,
you write it.
Oh, well, maybe we both write it then. How's that? Well, we write an article, we cross post on each other's blogs. Cause like, I really think this is important.
Yeah. Oh, and more people need to be talking about it. And I'm seeing that more people are. So that is heartening. Let me ask you this. What kind of engineer were you?
I was electrical engineer. Okay. Electrical engineer.
There's something. So I don't know. I have a very small sample size of one person, but I just know that one of the best CEOs that I ever worked for was a guy named Derek Peterson, who was a mechanical engineer. Uh-huh. And I think there's something about that engineering mindset that I just wonder if that's not if that doesn't sort of have some kind of good crossover when it comes to being a CEO. I don't know enough about engineering to know what that would be, but it's interesting to me to see. And then of course, software engineers are, you know, seem to do relatively well as well, but that may be more because of their background in software than engineering.
Well, yeah. I mean, so yeah, that's actually a good point. There is some great advantages to having an engineering mind, not only for running a company, but actually in politics, basically in everything. It's mm-hmm. when you take the extremes of it that it breaks down. So most engineers love to solve problems. That's why they became engineers.
Yeah.
They see problems in everything. If you ask an engineer, how's it going? They will list 25 problems they're trying to solve before they even get to the point where they're like, yeah, I did right. something good today. Right. And I used to have a mentor, actually still is a mentor, and one of the companies I founded, a guy named Jeff, and he would always tell me, Jari, you have to tell the whole truth. And I'm like, what do you mean? I'm telling the whole truth. He said, no, you're not. Like, you're only talking about the problems. What about the solutions? What about the wins? What about the good stuff? I'm like, who cares about the good stuff? And he's like, management cares about the good stuff because, right, if you don't tell the whole truth, they're going to think that everything's a problem. They're going to think the world's in chaos. They're going to think you're not doing your job. And I'm like, what do you mean? I'm doing my job. I got all these problems to solve. I'm solving all these problems. And he's like, yeah, but you just focus on the problems. And so engineers love problems and they love systems. They love frameworks. Yeah. They love just anything with a process. They just love that. And the reason is because the world to them has to be organized. Which if you're running a massive company, that's a great skill set to have. But if you're trying to be creative and you're trying to think outside the box and you're trying to like push the envelope a little bit, you're trying to be like a little more like more of an artist or a, you know, more free, like a writer mm-hmm. or whatever, gotta have, it's tougher. But yeah, I can see that. I've seen lots of both, depending on like the type of company. So interesting that you should mention that. Huh. What totally off topic. What was the kind of novel that you were thinking about writing? I know we talked a little bit about that ahead of time.
Well, I think one of my weaknesses is maybe that I don't really, when it comes to fiction, I didn't really have a lot to say. I didn't have a why. My why was just that I thought it'd be cool to write a novel.
Yeah.
Because I've always loved reading novels. And so every time I would come up with some idea for a novel, it was always like something really weird because I felt like I had to have something interesting about it because I didn't really have anything to say. So it just had to be that like, well, I may not have anything to say, but won't people think it's really interesting to read a story about a guy who was like disembodied by a teleportation machine and then had his like mind magnetically sucked into the brain of an alien or something weird, you know?
Yeah, super cool.
And those were always, I had all these strange ideas and I never really got them off the ground. And maybe one day that's the thing that probably that I need to work on is figuring out what I want to say. Because when it comes to nonfiction, when it comes to writing things for marketers, like I do on my blog, I have a point of view. I have things that I think, or that I found to work and I have a process that I like to walk people through and to help them get things together and get themselves to where they have an action plan. But when it comes to fiction writing, I don't think I have a strong enough point of view. And when I think about some of the more interesting novels out there, like if you ever read Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy.
Oh, yeah, I have.
You know what I mean? And even like, even in that, the judge or whatever his name was, I mean, that guy, that's a pretty interesting character. Or the hitman, the Javier Bardem character in No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
Also Cormac McCarthy, right? But yeah. You can still do really interesting stuff, but he's saying something. He doesn't tell you exactly what he's saying. You know, there's all kinds of people interpreting different ways, but it really seems as though he was trying to say something, which just makes for a better book in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I mean, and you know, when we talked a little bit before we started recording, you were talking about StoryGrid and why you liked StoryGrid and like listening to Sean and Tim talk about their journey, especially Tim's journey on writing The Threshing, which if you haven't read, I would highly recommend you read. It's a YA type, you know, book, but really well done. I mean, you know, excuse me, we've, you know, been listening to Tim grouse about it for 3 years on the podcast, and it's actually good that he finally got it out. And I'm actually not a huge fan of that genre, mm-hmm. but I can really appreciate, you know, how he, the pacing and what he tried to do. And, you know, it's a dystopian world and he did a good job. And I know he's working on the second one right now. But what's really cool is that the process, right? That's what StoryGrid's all about. It's the, you know, the problem's the problem. You're not the problem. Follow the process and the process takes care of itself. That's how you write, at least in the StoryGrid universe, which is still predicated, to your point, on a why. Like, why do I have to tell this story? That's, I think you can take that from the marketing, from books, from the politician. I think the whole kind of ecosystem of what people try to do with their lives all boils down to, well, why do you want to do it? And I think you made a great point about it's not the external trappings. It's like the inner why. Like, you know, what's your internal mindset? Like in your heart, why do you really want to do this? And that's a powerful thing because, as you know, there's ups and downs in the world, and those external trappings may not come. You may not get the fame, fortune, prestige. You may not get elected. You may come in third, which, good right. job anyway. You know? I mean, you learned. I mean, what did you learn? Like, oh, maybe I don't want to do this. I know from my own experience, people had actually at one point said, oh yeah, you should run for local supervisor. And I just remember talking to all the candidates, and we had all these sit downs, and I looked at the amount of effort. And then I met London Breed, who is now the mayor of San Francisco, but back then was running for supervisor. And I just remember looking at her. We had talked, I mean, it must have been 3 or 4 hours, just really in-depth conversation. And that she's trying to feel me out, right? I'm trying to feel her out. And I remember she said, so you're going to run? And I remember it like it was yesterday. I remember the cafe. I remember sitting down and I said, I don't have a chance in hell against you. So no, but how can I help? Right. That was the beginning right. of our friendship and my involvement with her. And I just felt like what a process to go through, and so much learning. And I think writing a book is not the same as being a politician, but this whole like selling yourself idea, really powerful.
And the why, in a lot of ways, is your fuel, because
yes,
for instance, with politics, the going does get tough. Writing a book, the going does get tough. Marketing a startup for somebody else, starting a startup yourself, like Derek Peterson, the guy I mentioned earlier, when he started Fusion Web Clinic, I mean, he wasn't taking a salary. He was a mechanical engineer. I can only imagine making the big bucks. He was working for some big oil company. But he just had this drive to be an entrepreneur. And if you don't have a reason, then it's going to be really hard when you get to that, whether it's that sticky point in your book where you just don't know what's supposed to happen next, or if it's, you know, something happens during your campaign. I remember some guy, poor guy, down here in South Carolina was running, and he tripped and he fell and he broke his leg.
Oh no!
And so that's bad enough. And then his campaign manager photoshopped his head onto somebody else's body because they didn't want a picture of him in a wheelchair and they needed a new picture. But the picture, the body that he put his head on, was in a lot better shape than his real body. And it's like, you know, so just terrible things can happen. And Murphy's Law is a real thing, and yes, you've got to be ready to, because even if you lose, even if you never finish your book, even if you finish it, nobody cares about it, you want to know that you had a reason for doing it, so you don't have to feel like, oh, why did I do that? You want to be able to answer. I was like, well, this is why I did it. It didn't work, but at least I know what I was aiming for.
Oh yeah. Man. Oh, that's just awful. I remember. Okay. I got to share a political story. I'm so, this is great. I can finally talk with someone about this stuff on the podcast.
Yeah.
I remember, it was London's first supervisorial campaign, you know, running against an incumbent. And we're at one of those political like clubs. Yeah, I'm sure you had to go to those, like Democratic Club, whatever. There's so many of them, right? And after the thing, you know, I was sort of with her that day. And after we did all the thing, there's a reporter outside wants to ask questions and stuff. And he was talking about, like, you know, oh, you're just in the pocket of the former mayor, who's Willie Brown. And he's just riding her pretty hard, right? I mean, really hard. Like, you know, and I could tell she's getting more and more upset because it was pretty disrespectful in one sense. And then she said something that I'm like, oh no, here we go. And I'm like I'm trying to pull her away from him, right? Like literally, like, oh, this is not going to go wrong. And it's probably one of the most famous things early on in her career, right? And I can't say the words because they're really bad words, but because I want to keep this, you know, family friendly. But I just remember going, oh, we're sunk. We're sunk. And then the next day, you know, the article came out and people were like, really, like, way to go. Like, I'm glad you stood up for yourself and, you know, all these things. I mean, the way she did it was not as, you know, well as it should have gone. And, you know, she apologized for using that kind of foul language and shouldn't do that, you know, and, you know, she was legitimately like, I could tell, like, wow, you're just frustrated and tired. And when you're on the trail, I mean, it's just, it's a grind. And, you know, you get hungry and you're at your 20th meeting. You've got all these people in your face and you've, you know, you're bathed in hand sanitizer. You know, I mean, it's, you know what? It doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on. I mean, I've come to really appreciate the people that put themselves out there. And I know a lot of it's an act, and I know a lot of it's like, okay, look, I know what you're trying to do. But I really have become to really appreciate the people that put themselves out there. And I typically give them the benefit of the doubt. And what people write about them, I know most of it's like false, because I remember, like, I mean, that one time was actually true, but I remember like so many other times where I'm like, that's not what she said. That's not what I said. I mean, I even would get misquoted. So I have an appreciation for that, but that was like, oh no, we're sunk. And then the next day it's like, oh no, we're not sunk. You know, just apologize, you know? Wow. Photoshop on a nicer looking body. Oh man.
Poor guy. And he was a really nice guy. And you know, he did know why he was doing it. He was a very principled person, and he was one of those people where I think a lot of times the people who win turn out to be the people who are often just in it for prestige or you know, those sorts of things that are less admirable. But the people who lose so often are these people who just really believe in what they're doing, and he is one of those people. And so it was so sad to see him get torn apart like that, because I mean, that's what people are out there to do. And it just gets more and more difficult to go out there and be a human being.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, they made a legitimate mistake, or, you know, I mean, I always, you know, it's like the fog of the campaign or the fog of war.
Yeah.
You know, you looked at, I don't know if you ever saw the movie by McNamara, which was sort of his atonement for Vietnam. It was literally called the fog of war. You know, okay, I can see during the time, you know, things get a little weird and you know, you're in your bubble, but you know, if you're trying to do the right thing, and I truly believe chances are most people are, or at least the right thing that's aligned sometimes in their self-interest, sometimes not. But real, I mean, just like, again, just like in being an entrepreneur, just like being an author, like that solid why, that guide star, the thing that you're like looking for, like if no one saw you doing it, would you still do it? Would you know, all the trappings are gone. Like, what's in your heart, you know? And I think that's just such a powerful thing.
Yeah, it is. And the fog of war is very, the fog of entrepreneurship is just as foggy sometimes. And it, you know, with a book, you're especially a first book, you're usually just doing it on your own, and there's nobody to get frustrated with, there's nobody to battle with. And that's something really to remember when you are working for a smaller startup or even a larger one. I genuinely believe people are almost always just trying to do the best they can do.
Yeah.
And what happens is when you get in those foggy situations, you start going down one trail, and then eventually you feel like you've gone too far to go back, and it doesn't make sense to somebody who maybe is, you know, maybe they're a new hire, or maybe they're just, they're not stressed in the same way, so they maybe are able to think more clearly, or maybe they don't have all the facts. There's so many different things that go into it. And I do try to view people's intentions as charitably as I can, because very few people are as monstrous as the sorts of characters that you might read about in a bad book, where it's just like a one-dimensional villain with no purpose other than to destroy people's lives and take over the world.
Yeah, that's certainly true. Yeah, I wish more people had that perspective. I really think we need more of that, you know?
Well, hopefully one day the internet will help us get there. I thought it was going to be more of a force for good. And I, I think it certainly has been in so many ways, but at the same time, it's things are very divisive right now. And I think a lot of that is just because we're just able to be at each other's throats on Twitter all the time now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's different when you can see, look someone in the eye.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and it's not even decorum. I think it's just the reality that they're human. There's a humanity there that's hard to communicate across the internet. I mean, even some of the most, during those campaign, that campaign, others, even this, you know, the enemy, so to speak, you know, the other candidates, when we would get together and be in the same room, you know, a little nicer, I think. And you know, even though we didn't, of course, they weren't our candidate, it's like, okay, I can see your point. You know, you're trying. I get it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, I think that's a humanity that's missing in the internet. I really do. And I think you said it great that way. It's hard to.
Yeah. And I was a, one of my biggest regrets is one of the first campaign I ever worked on. I was doing their social media and I was working for the candidate who eventually won. And he was running against a guy who I went to high school, his dad. He was running against a friend of mine's dad. And I, the guy we were, I mean, the guy mentioned me in his like valedictorian speech, you know, it was like, he was a nice guy. And, but his dad was running against the guy I was working for. And so I just was, you know, I mean, like I'm a amateur cartoonist and I was like writing, making these like insulting political cartoons and just all kinds of stuff. And I felt like at the end of it, when we won, we ran into some of the people on the other side. And I don't think it's possible that I had enough influence for this to be the sole result of what I had done. But, you know, I know they were really mad and I don't feel like my old friend took it very well. And I haven't talked to him since then. So that was very early on in my career. And I like to think that I learned a valuable lesson about that. And, you know, hopefully won't lose any more friends because
of
politics.
My rule was we don't draw first blood. So
yeah,
I cordial, fact-based, but then if someone comes after us, that's not cool. Because I never
get the knives out.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, again, don't bring a knife to a gunfight. It's like, yeah. And I would always try, and it's hard to do because of course negativity works, right? And that's the thing that pisses me off the most. You know, it's like I would much rather be fact driven and like, look, we generally have a disagreement. Okay, fine. Like even, you know, like doesn't matter what part of the political spectrum you're on. My whole philosophy is that if you sit down with someone over a meal to talk over coffee, doesn't matter where you guys come from or gals or whoever, however you identify, you will find a common ground. And most of that common ground is like, look, I just want to be successful. I want my family to be safe and I want to enjoy my life. I mean, there's hardly any, when you go, you know, person to person, there's not a lot of animosity, even if those people happen to be actually, you know, even in some cases, maybe racist or whatever. Like there's a lot of spectrum of folk. But we all kind of want the same thing. So, wow. You're an amateur. You didn't tell me you're an amateur cartoonist. Now you got to send me some cartoons.
I'll do it. I will.
Because I was looking to try to do a little bit of that just because it's super fascinating to me.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. And there's a great website. I think it's called drawabox.com.
Oh, okay.
And if you just want to get started and with doing some basic art, I found that to be a really interesting website.
Draw a box. I'm going to write that down. Because I have a hard time even drawing a box.
Well, by the time you're done with that tutorial, you will be able to draw a box and hopefully more.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, hey, Roy, this has been such a great conversation. I wish it could go on forever, but gotta wrap it up. And good luck, you know, with your new company. So awesome that you kind of started it during a pandemic and that it's going well. And, you know, just good luck to you.
Thanks, Jari. It's been great talking to you.
Thanks for listening to the Entrepreneur Ethos podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did creating it. My hope is that you learned something that can make you a little bit better. If you enjoyed the podcast, please do share it with friends and review it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also join my email list by visiting theentrepreneurethos.com to get my thoughts on what I'm doing to get better, as well as what I'm working on. You can also pick up my book, The Entrepreneur Ethos, if you want to learn the traits, values, and beliefs that I think we need to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient entrepreneur, and frankly, world community. Feel free to follow me on Twitter at TheDailyMBA and let me know if you have any questions or recommendations for a guest you'd like me to talk to. Also, drop me a note if you try anything we talked about on this or any other episode. I'd love to hear what's working for you. Until next time, keep getting better.
If you have a family relying on your income, you need life insurance. But finding the best quote shouldn't take a lifetime. That's where Policy Genius comes in. In minutes, Policy Genius could save you 50% or more simply by comparing quotes from America's top insurers. Once you apply, the Policy Genius team handles all the paperwork and red tape. To save on life insurance and get protection for you and your family, head to policygenius.com today.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.